today on Against the Grain. For Americans who are concerned about the ways that big agribusiness grows our food, whether it's the pesticides in vegetables, the ecological impact of food being shipped around the country, or the tastelessness of much mass-produced food, local food production on family farms seems like a good alternative. But as my guest today argues, there's a big blind spot in supporting local, small-scale food production, and that's the condition of agricultural workers. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'll be joined by political scientist Margaret Gray. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In a food system gone wrong, local small-scale production is most often presented as a solution. Local food is better than industrially produced food, it's argued, because it's more ecologically sustainable, it tastes better, animals are treated more humanely, and local food connects us to our local surroundings and builds communities. But is something missing from this picture? Why is it, asked my guest today, that consumers want to know so much, as they should, about pesticides on their fruits and vegetables and the hormones in their meat, but know almost nothing about the working conditions on the farms where their local food comes from? For a decade, political scientist Margaret Gray studied small and medium-sized family farms in the Hudson Valley, a rich agricultural region north of New York City, which produces bountiful food. In Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic, which is published by the University of California Press, Gray looks at the mystique around local small farms and examines the reality of the farmers and the farm workers. Margaret, tell us about the Hudson Valley region to start with, its history as an agricultural area, and its cachet now as a producer of local food.
Oh, sure. Hudson Valley has a very rich, rich agricultural history. At one point, it was the breadbasket of a very small nation growing grain. And one of the most interesting aspects, I think, about agriculture in the Hudson Valley is you had a tenant farming system that was sort of neo-feudal that set up some really interesting power dynamics. And, you know, at the end of the 19th century and through the middle of the 19th century, there were significant rent wars with farmer rebellions in order to get their own land. At the same time, in the lower Hudson Valley, you also had a freer agricultural movement that was very much the epitome of Thomas Jefferson's agrarian ideal and, you know, this sort of moment of anti-federalist democracy playing out from the farmer side of things. So that's really where the origination happens. Of course, with New York City just down the river, the move to a market economy happens in the early 19th century. And one of the other facets that's so fascinating about agriculture in the Hudson Valley is that it has constantly had to reinvent itself as competition first around the growing nation grows, and then of course, refrigeration. But even in the last 30 years, when you have places like China and New Zealand becoming major apple producers. So we've really seen a constant reinvention in the Hudson Valley. And the latest, of course, is a renaissance of agritourism. There's long been an agritourism sector in the Hudson Valley, but for a long time, and we're going back even to the early 20th century, it was catering to an immigrant population that moved to New York City that was seeking the land and seeking farming again. And so people might go vacation on farms or go up for a weekend just to have that farm exposure. Of course, agritourism today is very different, much more upscale. And there's so many restaurants in the Hudson Valley that really design their menus around local food. And then the final note I would add is that the Culinary Institute of America is right in the Hudson Valley. And so you have chefs being trained, and they're, you know, through their studies, they're also interrogating what local and what sustainable means. So it's a really fascinating place at the moment. And there's a lot of room for growth. According to the last agricultural census, only 1% of agricultural sales were local sales. So there's a lot of room for growth for an expansion in the local food market.
And now at the center of the Hudson Valley's production of local food are these family farms. And I wonder if you could tell us what a family farm looks like. The name conjures up a vision of a couple working on the land, perhaps with their children or the extended family coming over for the harvest. What does a family farm actually look like? What does that term even mean?
Well, let me tell you that more than 97% of farms in the United States are family farms. And in New York, it's upwards of 98%. And family farm, the term in and of itself, only speaks to ownership structure. So the official term family farm really means that the family owns it and plays some role in management, which means, of course, you could have family farms that are thousands and thousands of acres with several hundred employees. But according to the USDA terminology, that's still a family farm. In the Hudson Valley, because of the way agricultural developed around small towns popping up, because the parcels of land were doled out with this tenant farming system, and because it's rather hilly, agriculture developed rather small scale in the Hudson Valley. So the average farm size in the Hudson Valley is around 180 acres. Now, of course, 180 acres is also, you know, what does that mean? Because it means something very different if you're growing apples or baby arugula versus, you know, trying to have a small dairy operation. So in general, what we see in Hudson Valley Farm is that there's still very much a strong legacy of family-owned farms dating back generations. And there are some farms that are truly sustainable in terms of being a mom and pop operation, but those really aren't the farms that are helping to redefine local. What you have are farms in the Hudson Valley that traditionally sold wholesale, and the bottom of the wholesale market fell out over, you know, starting in the 1970s. So you've had very traditional farms reinvent themselves. And that's been something that's really fascinating to watch, because maybe you had a farm that was just a green bean farm that was no longer able to survive doing wholesale green beans, or no longer able to survive doing wholesale apples. So you've had a really nice diversity movement. So you've got these farms that were, you know, really doing one crop for wholesale that have become highly diversified. And those tend to be a little bit more medium size or even larger farms. And then some of the smaller farms that already had a rich diversity, really just in order to help sustain themselves. Because again, you can't monocrop in the Hudson Valley unless you have a boutique product, like maybe a raspberries or a baby lettuce sort of farm. So I guess what I would say is that there's just such a rich diversity in what the family farms look like in New York State. As in the rest of the country, a lot of family farms cannot survive just working the farm. So you often have one of the sole operators who has to work outside of the farm. But I think in general, people have this very romantic notion about what family farms are. And I can give you one example. There's a thriving family farm in the Hudson Valley that probably has around 60 employees. And when I interviewed the farmer, he was supplying to 30 to 35 farmers markets a week.
That's a lot.
Yeah, so that's pretty substantial. And then meanwhile, in my farmers market in downtown Manhattan, I do have the farmer, him or herself, coming to sell directly because they're a very small operation. So, you know, one of the ways to really get an interesting picture of the diversity is to walk around farmers market and to ask questions about the farms and to learn, oh, wow, this is, you know, this really is just a very small family farm that focuses on all sorts of greens versus a farm stand down the aisle that has, you know, and often the size of their stalls at the farmers market is an indication. But like I said, it's very difficult to nail down. So I think the best language to use is the Hudson Valley farms tend to be smaller than the farms around the country.
That being a relative thing. So what percentage of farms, is there the data on the farms in the Hudson Valley to know what percentage of them regularly hire the labor of non-family members?
Oh, you know, that's a really good question. I don't have the data in the Hudson Valley, but there's something like 35,000 farms in New York State, and roughly 16,000 of them hire outside labor. So a little less than half do. But again, the hired labor might be one worker who comes for 3 months, or it could be 27 workers who are there year round.
So what in your study of agriculture in this region, and you did your research over the course of 10 years, what did you find about the workers in the Hudson Valley? Because in this region, as in other parts of New York State, the workers are not a very clearly visible bunch. So who are they, in fact?
Yeah. So I mean, particularly for your West Coast listeners, the history of agricultural labor in New York State is just so different from what you've seen in the West Coast or even in the Midwest. Historically, starting with World War I, you really have Southern Blacks who are the primary migrant labor force in New York State. At the same time that the Bracero program was started in the West Coast, you had the British West Indies program on the East Coast. So you had Afro-Caribbean workers coming in to staff the farms. And I think a lot of your listeners will know the history of the Bracero program, the human rights abuses, and how it got shut down in the 1960s. And what's interesting is that the East Coast guest worker program never got touched during that same time period. And largely because it was a very different social movement in the West Coast. It was a Chicano and a Latino movement. On the East Coast, these very disenfranchised African-American and Afro-Caribbean workers had nothing like the same sort of social movement happening for them. You also had a fair number of Puerto Rican workers coming to New York State. But even in the region in the Northeast, New York really had this sizable population of workers of African descent. And starting in the 1970s is when, you know, when some of the first Latin American workers get hired. And then hiring Latin American workers really takes off in the 1980s. So there was a real aha moment in my research when I looked at some data by Cornell researchers, and it showed a very neat graph with a decline in Black workers, who again were both African American and Afro-Caribbean, completely mirroring the increase in Latin American workers. And so there's a whole chapter on my book that describes this ethnic succession from the Black workers to the Latino workers. When I started my research in 2000, I had a very difficult time meeting any citizen workers. I met one citizen worker who was from Texas, who self-identified as Mexican. I only met a handful of African American workers. And the Afro-Caribbean workers I met were guest workers who were coming to pick apples in New York State. New York brings in between 3,000 and 4,000 guest workers a year, largely for the apple harvest. So, you know, again, we're on the West Coast. You had an ethnic succession of workers take place at the turn of the last century. Here in New York, you really see this happen at the end of the 20th century. Of course, mirrors shifts in immigration around the country.
Margaret Gray is my guest. She's the author of Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So tell us about then the working conditions for these workers who are now primarily Mexican in the Hudson Valley region, close to north of New York City. What kind of conditions did you find these workers working under?
So I guess I would just start by saying that the shift from Black workers to Latino workers, I argue, was a very conscious shift on the part of the farmers, because the Black workers that they'd hired had largely become American workers. The Afro-Caribbean workers had gotten green cards. And it was really farmers' perception that they were no longer good workers, and that hiring Latino workers was a good decision because they had a much stronger work ethic. And I heard farmers go so far as to say, you know, you really don't want your workers to learn English, because once they start to get Americanized, they really get a little too lazy. So I think that the shift from Black workers to Latino workers is very representative of the fact that farmers are very much in need of cheap labor and laborers that will, you know, agree to the terms that they're offering, and really not protest their conditions or challenge their conditions. That was what I would say to set the stage for understanding labor conditions. Next is that in New York State, as in most other states, not California, of course, farm workers do not have a right to a day of rest. They don't have a right to overtime protections, and they don't have collective bargaining protections. As a citizen, if I took a job on a farm, legally, I could be working 70, 80, 90 hours a week at straight minimum wage without a day off. What you often hear the farm industry argue is, well, the harvest is very demanding, and farm workers can't always have a break, and they get a break when it rains. And there's this perception that the harvest is a very short-lived experience. But what I found from my interviews is that you have workers who go months at a time working upwards of 80 hours a week. In fact, there was a group of workers who told me that they got to work at 6 a.m. and they often didn't leave until 11 or 11:30 at night. They said they stayed in the fields until it got dark, and then they returned to the packing sheds to prepare everything for farmers markets the next day. And frankly, I didn't believe them, so I drove by their place of work on a couple of occasions. And indeed, those were the hours they were working.
And you're saying this is legal?
Yeah, that's completely within the law. Right. So that's actually not any sort of labor abuse taking place. But I think a lot of people might label that as labor exploitation, that folks can be working double the standard work week and only getting paid straight minimum wage. So the other factor I found is that, yes, there are labor abuses that occur. Probably some of the most common labor abuses have to do with wage theft, with, you know, farmers sort of just cutting the corners a little bit and paying their workers. And workers who really experience a rather extreme hierarchy. They don't speak the same language as the farmer. The workers often don't even have a high school degree. They're undocumented. You've got race and ethnicity at play. In addition to the fact, the workers I interviewed all lived on the farms and spoke about being afraid to go into local communities because they didn't feel accepted into local communities. So when they would get a paycheck and there might be 5 or 6 hours missing from the paycheck, they would often not say anything, try to assume there was a mistake on the farmer's part. And then when it happened again, they would have a conversation with themselves about whether this might be intentional, but they were hesitant to speak up. And then they find themselves in a situation where this happens over several weeks or over several months. And they feel at that point they've let it happen, that they can't even question the fact that they're not getting paid for the hours they've worked. The other finding I have about the labor conditions, and this I wasn't expecting to find, I thought this was completely fascinating, was the paternalism that took place on these farms. So migrant workers often work under a contractor who acts as a middleman. But in the Hudson Valley, because these farms really are relatively small, for the most part, you have the farmers themselves who are managing and overseeing the workers and paying the workers directly and knowing all the workers' names and assigning the shifts with no middleman at all.
Even though the farmer may not be fluent in Spanish.
Right. So usually they rely on a couple of workers who are more fluent in English, you know, so there could be very low level managers, maybe somebody who would be a shift leader in a way, you know, a sort of favored worker who's been working there for a couple of years. And like labor contractors, sometimes those shift leaders can play a role in helping discipline the workforce and getting them to work a little faster. But there's an intimacy that then develops when the workers know the boss so intimately this way. And what I found was that farmers would often do favors and extend benefits to workers. So, you know, I was on a farm once where the farmer was telling workers, oh, I'm going to go into Travelocity and see if the fares back to Mexico changed or any better right now, because workers didn't have access to their own computer and the farmer would play this role in helping them with that. Maybe giving access to farm vehicles to drive, allowing workers to take farm produce for themselves, allowing family members to live in worker housing. So these would be sort of low levels of help that farmers would extend. And the workers themselves would perceive these as benefits, of course. Then there were more extreme levels of paternalism where you might see a farmer really going out of their way to help a worker who had a sick family member and helping them with some sort of loan in that circumstance. I heard of farmers who were in touch with immigration lawyers and would tell their farm workers that they were trying to keep abreast of any changes in the immigration laws, which of course for these undocumented workers serves as some sort of promise that they might get a green card. And I even heard of more than one farmer who thought that he might pass the land on to the workers because he didn't have family members who wanted to take over the farm.
And yet, wouldn't all of these examples that you're giving reinforce the mystique around family-owned local farms, you know, so different than working in industrial agriculture, which is faceless. And here is the owner of the farm who's there to, in different ways, shelter the workers, help the workers out when life is tough, and do what sound like beneficial things for the workers. But what's the cost? What's the actual price of this kind of help?
Yeah, I think you are absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And I also believe that many of the farmers are being generous and care about their workers. But I think the bottom line is you can't separate this from labor control, because by definition, the way paternalism works is that the workers, they can never pay back these benefits. They will never be in a position to extend to the farmer similar perks. And so what's the one thing that these low-wage workers can offer is working harder, working faster, not complaining. So the paternalism, while it seems very generous and it seems filled with perks and benefits, what I argue is it is very much a form of labor control.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today we're talking about labor conditions on local farms. In particular, we're talking about the Hudson Valley region north of New York City, and I'm speaking with the author of Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic, which is published by the University of California Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Its author is Associate Professor of Political Science at Adelphi University, Margaret Gray. So one of the things that you were speaking about was the intimate relationship between workers and farmers on family farms in the Hudson Valley. And I wonder if you could talk about specifically housing and living conditions, because you've been saying that many of these workers live on the farms where they work, often in housing they don't pay for. What did you find in terms of the living conditions of these workers?
In terms of housing, this is a big struggle for farmers. And one of the areas where farmers can often feel most attacked, that a handful of photos might come out depicting very poor housing conditions and be such a bad reflection on farmers in this way, is very much a touchy issue. And I think for the most part, most of the farms that I saw, it looked like farmers were trying to offer decent housing. I certainly spoke to some farmers who, you know, weren't thrilled at the housing that they had to offer and wanted to improve the housing, but the cost involved was really high for them. One of the worst housing situations I saw was a really large house. And I remember when I visited it the first time, in the kitchen, there were probably three or four ranges set up for all these workers to do their cooking. And there was just grease everywhere. The bedrooms upstairs, there were bare soiled mattresses. It didn't really look like any place that you would want to live. And when I revisited it 6 years later, the place had been completely transformed. Everything had been repaired, all the appliances replaced, fresh paint on everything. So, you know, I think that's an example of where, you know, at some point the farmer really started to say, okay, that the housing has really gone downhill. There's a pretty interesting range of housing. Because you have these workers who are living year round, you would often go into a trailer that had a completely homey feel for it and was, you know, decently furnished with secondhand furniture, and the kitchen might be stocked and there would be a big screen TV. And again, these were largely places where workers would be living year round. Other places where you saw workers who were the migrant workers, it ranged. There were still some cement barracks that I saw, which were very rudimentary housing, with, you know, cots lined up in one big room. Sometimes you would see trailers that might be relatively new, but they had almost no furniture at all in them, or maybe even an outdoor table, an outdoor chair serving as furniture inside the trailer. There was one circumstance where I met workers who were living in a relatively new trailer, and they'd been working on the farm for a while, and they didn't have any mattresses. They slept on the floor of the trailer. Other housing was, you know, cardboarded up windows. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is a great, great diversity in housing. Some of it really looking like workers shouldn't be living there, but all of this housing is supposed to be inspected by the state every year if workers are going to be housed there. So I think that the New York State Department of Labor and the New York State Department of Health try to do the best job they can in working with farmers to try to bring the housing up to speed. I will say that the more recent research I'm focused on is on dairy workers in New York State. And there is no government body charged with inspecting the housing on dairy farms. And I've heard from workers that the housing on these dairy farms can be very poor and overcrowded, and sometimes inappropriate in terms of being attached to the milking barn or something like that. So again, it's very difficult to generalize about housing. And I think it's also, you know, when I speak to farmers about it, sometimes they're very much wanting to blame the workers for not taking care of housing. And if workers aren't taking care of housing, it leaves farmers with little incentive to do so. And in other cases, I think farmers are doing a really nice job. One aspect of the housing, though, is in terms of whether it's provided for free or not is completely up to the farmer. So I would say that that's another area where you see labor conditions play out, because you might have apple orchards just down the road from each other. And in the one apple orchard, you have workers who are given free housing, free satellite TV, free electric, free heat. And down the road, the workers are getting charged for all of the above. So that becomes entirely up to the farmer whether or not they're going to extend that sort of perk to the workers.
You mentioned a moment ago the state, New York State in this case, inspecting housing. And I wonder if you could talk about the role of the state historically and in the present in terms of farm workers. In the 1930s, the New Deal put in place various laws that were seen as being very friendly to labor, obviously in the context of a lot of labor upheaval. But those protections didn't extend to farm workers. And I wonder if you could explain why you think that is, and generally the way that the American government has regarded the crucial place of farms, especially family farms, and how that relates to the kinds of regulations and laws that are in place that might protect workers.
Cindy Hahamovich wrote an excellent book about East Coast farm workers, where she discusses how the state itself became the padrone, became the paternalistic entity in charge of housing workers and overseeing, and how that had become so problematic. And certainly, because of the history of agriculture, not only in New York State, but in the country, we know that the agricultural lobby is very strong, even though you've got less than 3% of the population who are actually engaged in farming. I think what we see play out in terms of policy, it's really pretty simple, and it boils down to the fact that farmers are long-term constituents of the politicians who represent them. And the farm workers are often nobody's constituents. So they have a history of being migrant. And of course, there were policies that established vagrancy laws or worker jail laws. So it would prevent farm workers from hanging around areas after the work was done. I think when you consider who farm workers have been and who they are today in New York State, when you think about African American farm workers in the 1950s, the 1960s, and the 1970s in New York State, in terms of political influence, in many ways, they were undocumented and at least treated in a very similar fashion, because there was significant racism against them. Often a pre-criminalization, the way you have with undocumented today, sort of assuming anybody who might want to go into farm work must have no other options and is probably engaged in criminal activity. So I think what you see is that the civil rights movement, of course, created so much positive change that allowed for Black workers to have more of a voice. And the undocumented today are playing a similar role in the labor arena. of becoming this voiceless population. But in New York State, when you have the vast majority of workers being undocumented, it's very difficult for legislators to recognize that they have concerns. And largely there's the sentiment that farmers deserve to have cheap labor. Why? Because they've always had cheap labor, right? And that the success of farming is going to be dependent on that. I would go so far to argue that the greatest subsidy to agriculture is farm worker conditions and farm worker wages. And that's entirely controlled by the state. So in terms of policy, you know, it, particularly at a national level, there's little opportunity, as farmers have, for pulling on Americans' heartstrings to help recognize what a vital industry they are and how they deserve to have these exceptions from the laws the way they do. I think in New York State, what I found is that the ethnic shift from Black workers to Latino workers, the state played an important role in that because the New York State Department of Labor helps place workers. And I would hear again and again from folks that workers who did not have Spanish-sounding surnames would not get recommended for positions at all by the state. What you also see today is that, you know, in this neoliberal moment, even departments of labor are charged with economic development and assuring the vitality of the industry. And so it can be very difficult for state-level players who have a closer relationship with the farmers in the state to play a role of the regulator, of the harsh regulator. So when you talk to farmers, they have a very, very poor image of the U.S. Department of Labor who might come in to do some sort of inspection of their records. But they often will tell you that the State Department of Labor is very friendly and very helpful. And I think even just on a more human behavior grounds, what you have is Department of Labor representatives who may be in their jobs for 5, 10, 20 years. And the people they really deal most directly with is the farmers, because the workers might come and go. They might not even speak the same level as the workers. So they really end up building strong relationships with the farmers and wanting to play a role in facilitating the farm's economic development by helping find the workers or helping to solve a labor issue sort of in a win-win scenario. So I think that the reputation that you hear when you talk to farm worker legal services folks or farm worker advocates, that workers go through the state with a complaint, it can take years for this to sort of get any type of attention, if it gets any attention at all. And as a result, workers cannot to contact the state when they have problems. And then, of course, the state can say, look, there really aren't that many problems on farms because we don't hear about workers complaining.
Sure. I'm speaking with Margaret Gray about her book, Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, just taking the other side for a moment, what you were saying about farmers' complaints about the state, that the Department of Labor is there to make life difficult for them. We often hear the narrative of how bad big agribusiness is in this country. Family farms, on the other hand, are supposed to be under a lot of duress and struggling to survive. Do you think it's the case that these farms would not be able to make it if wages were increased?
There are definitely some farms that would go out of business, there's no doubt. But let's look at this from a particular angle. So I was giving you an example before of two apple orchards that were side by side and one that was offering free housing and free satellite TV and free electric and free heat and use of farm vehicles. And the other orchard down the road wasn't offering any of that. So let's say an overtime bill was passed. The farmer who's already extending those free benefits, they could actually be charging for those benefits. So they have some little cushion there if that sort of law came into play. We also know the New York Farm Bureau has data to show that farm worker wages are often above the minimum wage. So again, if you're a farmer and you're paying $1 or $1.50 or $2 above the minimum wage, you have more flexibility there in adjusting the wages to accommodate for overtime. And of course, if the overtime kicks in after 55 hours a week, let's take that as an example. If your workers are working an average of 60 hours a week, you know, that's probably not going to kill you to pay on average that 5 hours of overtime. But if you're the farmer of some of the workers I met who are regularly working 85 to 95 hours a week, it's going to really hurt if an overtime bill passes. So, you know, I think it has a lot to do with whatever the current business practices are in terms of how much it would hurt if, for example, an overtime bill did come to fruition.
I'd like to talk about the mystique that surrounds production by small family farms of local food for farmers markets and community-supported agriculture, and talk about why there's such a disconnect between the sort of mythology and the mystique around these things and the reality, as you've been discussing over the course of this hour, about working conditions for workers on these farms, their living conditions, the kind of vulnerable position they are in with relationship to their employers, particularly vulnerable, and the role of the state in all of this. You know, there seems to be, in the past several decades now, there's been a great deal of attention in at least certain sectors of American society about where our food comes in and what are the circumstances under which our food may be grown. Is it an heirloom variety of tomato? Are pesticides being used? Are there antibiotics being put into the meat that some people eat? And all of these very focused questions about the production process that ends up bringing the food to our table, but very little focus, if any, on the question of under what circumstances do the workers labor who pick this food? And I wonder why you think that's the case, and if you think that some of these quite popular food writers, people like Michael Pollan, Marion Nestle, amongst others, are contributing to a kind of incomplete notion about the food that we're eating when they're pushing a whole turn toward local food.
I think one of the main reasons why there's such a disparity in what the public and consumers are expecting from local and what it actually is, has to deal with romantic agrarianism. So long, long history of romanticizing agricultural living in U.S. history. Even today, the way we've had a whole slew of books in the Northeast come out by folks who abandoned Wall Street to get dirt under their nails and talk about the transformation and the personal transformation and how they feel that they're doing something good by feeding the nation or even their local communities. So, you know, one of the main tenets of romantic agrarianism is this idea that farming is intrinsically wholesome and good. And I would say that our romance with farms and our perceptions of that and of the family farm or the small farm or the local farm are all very much wrapped up in that romance. I think a great example of how it plays out today is through food writers and some of the food writers that you've mentioned. So Michael Pollan in The Omnivore's Dilemma, he describes two types of farming. He says that this whole chapter on industrial farming, and then he's got a chapter on pastoral farming, right? So even that term pastoral is a very aesthetic term that brings to mind these, you know, the pastoral landscape or the landscape painters. And of course, the pastoral landscape has this rich, rich tradition of the Hudson Valley School of Painters. What we see again and again is that the way food writers talk about agriculture and talk about food, it lays this romance on really thick. And I think anybody who's into food, we, you know, forgive the pun, but we eat that up. We really enjoy that sort of writing. And we want to feel good about our food purchases. So if there's stuff out there that's telling us that buying local is a way to have a voice against the corporate system, we want to embrace that. I think we also have to keep in mind that in places like New York State, rural New York State is very, very far away from the farmers markets of New York City. And workers, these Latino workers in particular, and the Black workers who came before them, they weren't integrated in local communities. They didn't have neighborhoods that they lived in local communities. This is very much in contrast to what we've seen in California over many, many decades. So you have these workers living on farms. They don't have cars of their own. In New York State, because they're undocumented, they don't have access to driver's licenses. And so they're entirely dependent on farmers or for paying for rides because there is no public transportation infrastructure for so many of these rural areas. So these workers are literally hidden from the public view. They're hidden on the farms. And what you see is that they're not comfortable going into local communities. They don't want to go into small town downtowns because they can feel resentment toward them. They're concerned that they don't speak English, and that's going to be a problem in local shops. So they're going to go to the nearest small city where they can go to a Walmart to go shopping and blend in more. So they're very, very much even cloistered from local communities in that sense. And I think coming back to the food movement, if we think about the success of the food movement, I think consider it as an education campaign and the very important role that food writers have played in educating us about how our food grows, the importance of eating seasonally, why organics matter, what does it mean that industrial agriculture is poisoning the land and the waterways. And then, of course, the humane approach to farming that would treat animals better. I think if you look at the food movement as an education campaign, what the food movement has really been most successful at is training the consumer to better understand the way our food is grown, the way our food is raised. And then armed with that knowledge, we as consumers go out and start asking a whole bunch of questions. You know, I remember one farmer telling me he got so sick of asking questions about pesticides that he created a handout. And every farmer I interviewed, I asked them, okay, so at the farmer's market, what sorts of questions do you get about your workers? What do they ask you about your laborers? And farmers would be scratching their heads to say, well, nobody ever asks us any questions at all about our workers. So I think that, you know, the next move, and to his credit, Michael Pollan has started to speak about farm workers and food workers as being the next pivot point for food writers to interrogate and to really start to discuss sustainability. And I think that the food movement and the food writers, the more that they can play that role in now educating us about the conditions of workers, that would go a long, long way. I think what else I would add is that when you think about the disparity in what people are expecting from local and what actually happens, I think that food writers have given us an inflated idea of how much we care about sustainability. And I think that there are large segments of the public who feel that they want sustainability in their own bodies. They want sustainability in the bodies of their children, and that this is to a large extent about their health, and that there's, they might be a justice related, whether it's animals or environment, element to it, that that's great as well. And so I think that maybe we've overstated the way folks are interested in sustainability. I think also, particularly when you think about the treatment of animals, everybody understands that animals have no choice at all in the conditions that they face on farms. But people are expecting that the workers have some choice in where they are. Everybody you talk to has some story to tell about how they worked in, you know, they worked in a McDonald's when they were a kid, or in the back of a kitchen, or they had to wake up at 5 a.m. to do this job or the other job. And so I think sometimes there's a sense that you pay your dues with the grunt jobs and you work your way up. And then finally, we can't underestimate the sentiment that folks have about immigrants. And it's twofold. On the one hand, there's this sense that, you know what, they're sending all their money home and they want to go home. So $9 an hour, that's pretty good. That's way more than they would ever earn in their home countries. And so we can justify it that way. And I think the other way that folks look at it is that these immigrants shouldn't be here in the first place. So why would we be concerned about their rights, and why would we fight for their rights? So, you know, in sum, I think that the food writers, whether they're bloggers or writing for The New Yorker or whatever media outlet it is, could play a really significant role in trying to spread the word that even these local farms have workers. And a lot of the conditions on these local farms largely mirror the conditions that workers face on the corporate monocultural farms, where we expect labor conditions to be bad.
Margaret Gray, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Margaret Gray is the author of Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic, which is published by the University of California Press. You can find a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at Adelphi University. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.